it's a kind of like a woke particularism of its own kind, because it's saying like this attempt to make all the world cookie cutter the same is bound to fail and will only backfire. So in the slogan of the far right now, right, a place for every race.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own tradition. There just shouldn't be this sort of crossing of the boundaries that keep us all in the containers where we flourish.
From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, making sense of contemporary problems by looking back at books that shaped the world we inherited, and perhaps never so insidiously and malevolently as the ones we're going to be looking at today. To my left, anthropologist and non-benevolent anthropologist and Latin Americanist Elizabeth Ferry, non-malevolent, also benevolent.
Milieuristic.
And I am John Plotz, not very insidious, non-eminent Victorianist. And we're your hosts today. So, strong words, malevolent and insidious. So why? Because our topic today is the anti-immigrant xenophobia that now circulates on the political right, and two of our chosen texts from 1973 and 1974 turned out to have a far-reaching impact in encouraging the libertarian right to evolve or devolve towards a closed border policy as regards human movement. In order to have this conversation, we're joined today by Wellesley College professor Quinn Slobodian. Quinn, hi. Thanks for coming.
Hi.
Quinn is a historian of modern German and international history with a focus on North-South politics, social movements, and the intellectual history of neoliberalism. So he's the author of many great articles and an edited collection and a pair of books, but I came to his work, as I bet many people, many of our listeners did, through his really brilliant book from last year, Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism. So, Quinn, we are huge admirers of your work in general, but we asked you here today, to talk about this question of texts from the past that help us understand some of the strains of xenophobia we've got today. So can you tell us about the book you brought with you?
Sure.
Show and tell
moment.
I'm
glad to say that I don't have a paper copy of it and don't intend to buy one. So this is a version downloaded from the internet of a book called The Camp of the Saints by the French author Jean Raspail. It is the idea that came to me because novels don't come up actually that often in the readings that I do of kind of right-wing libertarian political theory or neoliberal constitutionalist political theory. They don't sort of root their arguments in novels as much as actually I would like. They do make reference to theology. They do make reference occasionally to art and certainly classical philosophy. But novels don't come up that often. However, this one does come up, The Camp of the Saints, and it doesn't just come up for them. It was published in 1973, and the scene that it sets is some combination of young missionary, left-wing, French, white do-gooders and a kind of inchoate, pre-rational, id-driven mass of non-white humans, almost humans, subhumans in India have hatched this plan to form what ends up being called the Last Chance Armada, which is two large rusting steamers setting sail from around Calcutta and heading towards Europe with a ragtag flotilla of rafts and dinghies and whatnot attached to the back, amounting to this floating city of about a million people. The drama of the novel is the fact that the West feels paralyzed by its inability to do what the author clearly thinks is the right thing, which is just to turn away this mass of diseased and starving people out of their own self-interest. Instead, the West has this monkey of liberal guilt and supposedly, post-colonial angst on its back, which leads country after country to think that at least they need to make some kind of a pretense of welcoming this coming flotilla, the coming armada. And ultimately, the armada ends up landing, setting alight in the south of France. And what ensues is basically what Rod Dreher, the conservative columnist, would call in 2015 the suicide of the Christian West, whereby the white French people essentially come running with open arms and are promptly slaughtered and raped and expropriated, and the country of France is taken over then by this advance guard of brown people.
Hey, Quinn, can I just jump in here?
Because
I almost feel like we should have had a trigger warning just even to hear the plot summary.
Sure.
It's like
yes.
It's heavy stuff. But but that pattern that you're describing here in, obviously, in 2019, it's all too familiar, that kind of rhetoric, mm-hmm. that notion that anybody crossing any border, including the U.S.'s southern border, is somehow part of the trail of, you know, quote, rapists and murderers, or, you know, that notion of the, what I think Respai calls it, the anti-world at one point.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you set the scene for, like, 1973, which I associate with, you know, free love and the shadow of 1968 and stuff like that? Was it pretty normal on the right in Europe for books like that to be published in the 70s? Or does this stand out even then?
I think it does stand out. I mean, part of the reason why it's become so iconic or canonical for the far right is that it did sort of anticipate moral panics and kind of hysterias that would come later. I mean, it's notable that the wave of the Vietnamese boat people refugee crisis hadn't hit yet.
Right.
That wouldn't hit until...
That's like 78 or something.
Yeah. That would, in fact, end up triggering some of the very things that Respai describes, i.e., high-profile leftist intellectuals like Sartre and Arendt and Foucault coming out in favor of refugees. So what you had at that time was, it wasn't really a time of panic about mass immigration, because there actually wasn't a great deal of mass immigration unless you set aside the migrations from within the French Empire, from French North Africa and French West Africa.
Right.
Those weren't new. Those had been happening all through the 1960s. So it was peculiar to hit upon this idea of sort of the invasion of brown people into Europe. It was, in that sense, a kind of a leap of fantasy for him, which I don't think he wasn't narrating, tearing things from the headlines to come up with this plot.
Can I maybe read a quote that I wanted to ask you about,
Quinn,
that relates to that? There also seems to be some 1789 language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in other words, that, like, there's a line, the human race, the good thing that we've learned from this raft is that, quote, the human race no longer formed one great fraternal whole, as mm-hmm. the popes, philosophers, intellects, politicos, and priests of the West had been claiming. So that notion, no more fraternity, was interesting to me because, you know, I think of that as like one of those core claims of Frenchness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's, you know, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. So this is why it's a kind of a text of like the new right, I think, in the sense of the Nouvelle Droite, because it is a rejection of universalism.
Yeah.
But... Mm-hmm. In favor of, it's a kind of like a woke particularism of its own kind, because it's saying like this attempt to make all the world cookie cutter the same through processes of westernization, Americanization, modernization is bound to fail and will only backfire. So in the slogan of the far right now, right, a place for every race.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own tradition. There just shouldn't be this sort of crossing of the boundaries that keep us all in the containers where we flourish.
Can I just underline that phrase, a woke particularism? I mean, that's great, because I do feel like that's so much of what we're struggling with right now, is that question of particularism and all the different varieties of identity politics, which we wish to make minute distinctions about, but we need to be able to recognize commonalities as well.
Sometimes not so minute.
Yeah, there are non-minute distinctions too, but I mean the phrase woke particularism I do think covers like a that notion of people's in their place. So Quinn, I wanted to follow up on, I want to make sure that the way I introduced you was correct, which is that I said that the thing about this text that's interesting is that it had this effect on sort of shaping far right, like right libertarian thinking. Mm-hmm. Help us understand like the alliance, the unholy bedfellowness there of exclusionary politics around migration coupled with libertarian economic policy.
Yeah. Well, right. So it's been a popular book, not only certainly for right-wing libertarians, just for right-wing people of all kinds. A relatively mainstream example in the United States is Patrick Buchanan, who cites it in, I think, all of his books from the 1990s, all of which have titles that recall the Camp of the Saints, things like The Immigrant Invasion, The Third World Arrival, .. Population Decline, Suicide of the West, The Death of the West. And he cites Raspai and its subsequent reception, its praise by people at the National Review and the Wall Street Journal, as being this prescient prophecy of demographic decline. So it does get used in that way as an outright piece of propaganda for nativist exclusionary politics, which don't always, and in fact often don't, run libertarian in the sense that they then lead into calls for an enhanced welfare state for the right kind of white people, pronatalist policies, and encouraging higher birth rates and so on. So
in other words, there's a consistent right wing protectionist nativism or something in which borders are just borders, and this kind of hatred is totally justifiable and logical because it goes along with that sort of segmentation of the world.
Right. So, yeah. Exactly. And because you see these particularist demographic communities as bearers of both specific cultural traditions and memories and sort of forms of self-narration that need to be preserved and will be diluted if a new population comes in, then it's all quite logical.
Yeah.
But the libertarian thing is kind of the twist, and that was the surprising part for me. And the main person to mention there is Murray Rothbard, who's extremely well-known libertarian. He's considered the father of what's called anarcho-capitalism, which is a very extreme form of libertarianism in the sense that they don't believe in just a small state or a very tightly constrained state, but no state at all. So the argument is you can replace all state functions. You won't have taxes. You will replace otherwise state functions through contracted private services, whether it's private security forces, third-party arbitration. Sounds like there will be a lot of law in this world, but it isn't law mediated by the state. It'll be sort of the same way that transnational private law is mediated between corporations. It doesn't necessarily always go through governments.
Yeah. I read a lot of 1970s and 80s science fiction, and you can see that all the time because they're constantly thinking about, who's going to run the asteroid belt.
Right.
The answer
is
like a bunch of dirty miners who get together and, and execute people because that's what they do because they're justice.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And who will compensate for the loss of the cargo? Well, they'll turn it over to this insurance company or that insurance company. You don't need a state actually to have insurance companies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So insurance companies also take on an increased role. One of the many ways that I think these right-wing libertarians.
Cryptocurrency?
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, some kind of scarce commodity-based currency that cannot be manipulated by public authorities in the way of fiat money, which they all see as the beginning of the end of civilization as we know it.
Oh my God, the Dune books are all about insurance companies running the world because that's true. The monarchies are meaningless. It's the space guild, and there is some insurance scheme. That's really interesting. And those are the 70s too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
I'm sure the list goes on. I can only assume. Yeah. But with Rothbard, so the traditional libertarian position is. I think it's best put by someone in the Q&A at some conference I was watching online recently. Said, we're like astronauts. We see the world from a million miles away.
Huh.
We don't see borders. We don't see states. We just see territory, and we don't see humans. But if we got closer, we'd just see humans. And you can't see, of course, borders from the sky.
Oh, my God. It's the blue marble as libertarian fantasy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. So the normal position is no borders.
Yeah.
Because how do you have borders if you don't have states, right?
Yeah.
Well, the right-wing libertarians have solved that one. And their model is basically the covenant community or the gated community. In other words, people come together and they sign some sort of a binding document about decision-making and shared responsibilities. And then that territory becomes, beholden only to their law, and there's no higher authority. Mm-hmm. So they start sort of theorizing this in the 1970s, but then really more into the 1980s and 90s. And the thing that really gets them talking about what is closed borders libertarianism is this increased concern about South-North immigration and the feeling that and it's an extension of the 1960s backlash against desegregation in the sense that they use the same term that what immigration is actually forced integration because you then have to confront these people who you had no choice in having around you, but they're on your roads, they're in your public schools, they're in your parks, So that's an incursion on your personal liberty, right?
So your covenant did not include
exactly.
Those people,
right? So if you
that was not what
right,
I meant.
Right, exactly.
So this may be getting a little bit too in the weeds, but isn't there a Lockean history of this debate between like a tacit consent versus explicit consent?
Mm-hmm.
Like in other words, like someone who takes up citizenship in a country is like explicitly consenting, but then there's this whole other social structure of just like the things that we tacitly buy
yeah.
into.
Yeah, I mean it's all a kind of an expansion of the question of whether the social contract is meant literally or figuratively, right? I mean, because most of the time it is figurative.
Yeah.
But their argument is really that it is possible now to make it literal, and you should be able to have what Rothbard calls nations by consent. And that consent might not be abstract if you create a new nation, either through secession or settlement of a otherwise unsettled territory.
Yeah.
So it's in the 90s with this is happening across the right. Is that the end of the Cold War means the common enemy of the communists is gone, and the new enemy really becomes the non-white immigrant. And a lot of the conservative magazines pivot quite hard in that direction, from Chronicles on the one hand, this is the kind of organ of the paleoconservatives to which Rothbard is aligned, and the National Review itself in the 90s, of course, takes up immigration much more aggressively than before.
So post-1989.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the book comes out in 73.
Yeah.
And the other article we're going to talk about, I think, is from 74.
Mm-hmm.
But you're talking about, like, so 16 years later.
Oh, yeah.
There's, okay.
And it's republished and then
yeah.
made available, for example, on the website of American Renaissance, which is the central white nationalist
right.
organ. So it becomes... Yeah, it becomes, as someone on American Renaissance reviewed it, the 1984 of our times, right? This thing that was written a while ago, but only now can we
right.
see how accurate its vision of the future
and
was.
And so this is all... So maybe this is a good time to
yeah.
pivot, because so far we've been thinking about this. You know, we haven't talked about Mr. Respai personally, still
no,
alive.
That's okay, yeah.
Feel free to visit him. but you know, that makes this seem, you know, you can see the Euro side of this. But of course, actually, there's an American side of it as well. So I think, Elizabeth,
yeah.
you were going to talk about.
Yeah, well, so as you were saying, John, just around the same time, the thing I wanted to bring in was an article by The Economist. And ecologist, I guess, Garrett Hardin, which is called Living on a Lifeboat. And, you know, I kind of see this as the sort of domesticated or sort of legitimate, reasonable-sounding version of the argument.
The biologized, for sure.
Biologized yeah. version and, you know, reasonable people
right.
or
so I think
maybe
he's a,
men
is
can
he's
agree.
He's a professor of human ecology in Santa Barbara, I think, in 1974 when
that
he publishes it.
That sounds about
it.
Right. He's,
yeah.
he's trained at Chicago.
Yeah.
And he's most famous for an argument in an article called Tragedy of the Commons, which is arguing that because the commons is not seen to be the property of any particular person or group, there's no incentive to take care of it, and then there's a sort of gradual, generalized degradation of it, right? So this is kind of not a surprising... And this argument, the tragedy of the commons, is extremely widespread, and I think in many circles not particularly called into question, like sort of taken as a self-evident thing, even though... Plenty of people have pushed back against it, maybe most famously the economist Eleanor Ostrom, who talks about how all the ways in which, in fact, the commons is regulated through different kinds of corporate groups like states or unions or there's a famous ethnography called Lobster Gangs of Maine about how the commons of lobster fishing is in fact, managed quite well. So I wanted to start maybe by just by reading this metaphor that sort of encapsulates the argument. So he says, metaphorically, each rich nation amounts to a lifeboat full of comparatively rich people. The poor of the world are in other, much more crowded lifeboats. Continuously, so to speak, the poor fall out of their lifeboats and swim for a while in the water outside, hoping to be admitted to a rich lifeboat or in some other way to benefit from the, quote, goodies on board. What should the passengers on a rich lifeboat do? This is the central problem of the ethics of a lifeboat. And, you know, he, like Respai, although in a more sort of reasonable sounding version, is sort of placing a lot of the responsibility for kind of environmental and political degradation at the hands of people who believe that they're doing the right thing, right? Who are taking the idealistic view. He's sort of equates them with Christians or Marxists at one point.
Doesn't he actually, but he makes a sort of pointedly, I mean, I might be misremembering the article, but doesn't he make a pointedly anti-racist side to his argument where he says, look, set the abilities and the contributions of the people at zero.
Let's
like, say they're all
zero,
the same.
However they are.
Nonetheless, we don't want them in our lifeboat.
Yeah, right. It's a carrying capacity argument.
Yeah.
It's an ecology argument.
Yeah.
We are just other organisms.
Right. There isn't going to be enough to go around, and therefore...
Right.
We are going to need to make choices, and liberals are not willing to make those choices because they succumb to these idealistic arguments, right?
And it's contemporaneous with, of course, like the Club of Rome's Limits to Growth report, right? But rather than scaling it up to the world to say, what changes do we need to make given these limits, his point is it's the world doesn't exist as an active political category. There's no world government.
Right.
So we need to think about this only at the level of the nation. And when you do that, zero-sumness comes back, like with
right.
a vengeance. Right,
right, right. And there's no sense of the sort of system within which these different lifeboats are operating.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's
there's no effective. There's no effective form of collective decision making.
Right. Right. Yeah.
That he said. I mean, he has this snide thing about the UN. Right. The UN is only there insofar as governments give it the impression of making decisions at the moment.
Yeah. And it has no power because it decided not to have power.
Or the states decided not to give it power.
So that's like the opening is the dueling metaphors of spaceship or raft. And so the point is, if there were a spaceship, there would be a captain.
There'd be a captain,
right.
Or at least a crew.
Right. I think I might push back on the idea that it's exactly an anti-racist argument as much as a avoiding...
Non-racist.
Right. And I didn't even mean structurally non-racist. I just meant putatively in terms of it. Whereas the Respai argument, I just think it's just worth noting how much he doubles down on his racism, because even like the stench and the squalor of the raft in the Respai novel, which you would think is an effect of like being on a raft, becomes instead an attribute of like the people who are stinky and dirty.
Right. And there's this kind of horrible luxuriating in the raceness in Camp of the Saints, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Hardin, you know, I mean, not surprisingly, as an economist, he's basically sort of saying let difference equal, you know, be null, right? He's sort of we're gonna write a formula in which that is written out, right?
Well, it sort of raises the interesting question of like whether race blindness actually matters within these arguments. Like, if you can make the same argument without resorting to the racial rhetoric, is the racial rhetoric? I mean, this might be a question about the Respai, whether the racial rhetoric is an instrument is an integral part, or it's just
Well, I think it matters
dressing.
Because it makes it more palatable to frame it in these terms.
For Hardin. Yeah, but Respai actually clearly struck a note as well by going to the other direction.
But
so.
I think that, I mean...
But it's easy to see, or it's easy for many people, certainly not for everyone, but it's easy for many people to see that Respai is outside of the pale for many, right? Whereas Hardin in many circles seems perfectly reasonable. Right?
But Quinn, are you saying that these are sort of rhetorical and stylistic differences? And this, in a way, we could turn this question to like what the Republican Party is acting like nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are lots of hardened type people in the Republican Party. Like there are people who are going to try to seek out that respectable scientific center. And clearly there are inflamers also, like people who love the idea of...
Yeah, the Steve Kings.
And not just Steve King, but also, as you said, Bannon, like people who work by inflaming
the insensibilities of the left.
And so are those merely rhetorical differences between a fundamentally unified right-wing ideology that has a kind of rational, political, non-racial tinge on one side and a totally openly racist tinge on the other side? Or are those actually two different ways of looking at the world that just happen to be traveling in the same Maserati together?
Well, I mean, I think it gets tricky if you think about climate change too seriously, right? And this might be a good chance to sort of segue into the third book we hope to talk about, because sure, it can seem, you know, small-hearted and kind of unethical at some level to take on Hardin's lifeboat ethics. But there must be at least some way in which he's right, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in the sense that we are dealing with a situation of limited, not just limited resources, it's actually much worse than that, you know, rapidly mm-hmm. transforming planet that will change the terrain around us. So in that sense, the difference mm-hmm. that you're describing, John, between sort of an overtly racialized or culturally coded form of right-wing rhetoric versus the at least formally non-racist forms of economistic right-wing rhetoric do become quite consequential, because it's the question then of who you are selecting. It's the criterion of selection for the lifeboat in a way, right? I mean, I don't think it's that
well, but is that true though, Quinn? Let me just to understand. I hear yeah. what you're saying about yeah. the conservatism. Yeah. I know that. I mean, I remember that from the first George mm-hmm. Bush. Like, right. I totally accept the existence
Ryan
of that. Yeah. But the just to stick with the lifeboat metaphor for a minute, mm-hmm. I mean, okay, fine. It has these environmentalist and population bomb roots. Mm-hmm. But just as I think you were saying, Elizabeth, the selection of the lifeboat as nation as unit of analysis, mm-hmm. like that by itself doesn't, there's nothing environmentalist about that. That's just like a way of justifying segregation, basically, balkanization.
Right.
Sure, but I mean, insofar as any solution to, or not even solution to, any sort of mitigating approach to the coming climate catastrophe, we'll have to sort of choose the scale at which it operates, I think, that you know, whether or not that, where that's, you know, it's the question of kind of communitarianism. Like, mm-hmm. will it, you know, what is the size of the vessel that makes sense? Not as, like, is there a way of thinking about yeah. the lifeboat metaphor? You know, is there yeah. something between spaceship Earth and lifeboat nation
yeah.
that could actually be operationable as, like, a non-reactionary yeah. politics or
yeah,
political
metaphor? Yeah, I mean, one, you know, it's, there's sort of on the one hand this sense of the zero sum,
yeah.
right, which is the ethics of the lifeboat.
Yeah.
But then what are the principles of redistribution
yeah,
according
exactly.
to which that
yeah.
game gets played, right?
Yeah.
And that's the, that seems
well,
like the
yeah.
difference.
And it's
say.
And it's too bad we didn't choose as our third text this other amazing film, Quinn, that you sent me, which we can put a link to, this film Libra from
yeah.
the late 1970s, which is a libertarian fantasy about escaping to a satellite. Basically,
yeah.
that where it's not a zero-sum game. It's I think I had a T-shirt when I was a kid that said, "The meek shall inherit the earth, and the rest of us shall escape to the stars."
Oh,
so,
really?
You know, like,
oh, nice one, yeah.
So
yeah.
before we go to our third text,
yes.
I wanted to maybe shift it a little bit to talk about water and boats and
yeah.
land.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
clearly there's some like geographic, you know, mm. relevancy to these kinds mm-hmm. of metaphors of the lifeboat and the armada.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third text, you know, that the lifeboat and the rising seas
mm-hmm.
is picked
mm-hmm.
up. But I think that those do other kinds of work in the text, too. So
mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what you guys think about that.
Well, I mean, at a basic level, this is a perfect segue to, I think, the,
it
third,
is,
the
I agree,
third book.
Yeah.
But you know, ironically, the Camp of the Saints might offer us a bit of a way out in the flotilla, in the armada, right? I mean, because mm-hmm. what is that but a collection of tethered together lifeboats,
mm-hmm.
but one that then produces its own collectivity and its own kind of
mm-hmm.
integrity somehow. And I mean, if again, to sort of flip the script on Respy, if this is actually true, it's an extraordinary vindication of kind of vanguard politics, right? I mean, how is it exactly that a million people end up taking over France, a country of, you know, dozens of millions? Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's like because a million people showed up in Germany in 2015,
mm-hmm.
and the result was not the total transformation of the fabric of Germany.
Right.
So that vision of like many, many small lifeboats
mm-hmm.
sort of acting as one might be something that
yeah.
might be slightly redemptive.
The other sort of, you know, quiet metaphor that I felt like, especially in Camp of the Saints, but I think it's there in the others, is the Middle Passage and the slave
mm-hmm.
ships.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Especially in those descriptions of the bodies being all packed in together,
right.
you know, reminded me. I mean, I don't know that it was at all consciously in Respy's mind, but reminded me a lot of those diagrams of the slave ships
yeah.
and this whole sort of, you know, what kinds of movements of different kinds of people across the globe.
Yeah.
Have been going on,
and the,
what does that,
yeah,
what does that
and
mean?
And the historical sociologist Jason Moore he's recently titled something "Slave Ship Earth,"
mm.
right?
Mm.
So that is
yeah.
something
wow.
that people have also played.
That's
with
fascinating.
As,
yeah.
Play is not the right
metaphor. And another group of anthropologists has talked about the planet as a plantation economy.
Right.
Yeah. So this is a great segue, actually, to the John Lanchester book. So John Lanchester, I hope I'm saying his name right, he's kind of like an English Tom Wolfe of the 2010s. So he's a journalist who probably became best known for a satirical novel about neoliberalism called Capital. And now he just came out just a couple of months ago with this novel, The Wall. And there's a premise that an island nation, which is explicitly not Britain, you could call it, Schmitten, you know,
seems
to have many pubs, and the weather is always extremely gray.
There's a lot of tea being drunk.
Yeah, there's a lot of tea. Lot of tea. Yeah. At one point, they make a joke about anti-aphrodisiacs, and someone says, "Yeah, it's called tea." So it's an island that is surrounded its entire border with a wall, and I think this is exactly to the point that that we've been talking about. The wall is in response to two different things. It's in response to environmental disaster, so climate change, rising seas, and also heat elsewhere, and then also the immigration that is a consequence of that. So it's like a flood of people imagined almost as like part of that natural flood.
Right.
And then in the face of that, it's a very kind of stripped down dystopian account in which every title has a capital letter associated with it. So people have to go and guard against the others with a capital O. And to do that, they become defenders with a capital D.
And the climate change is the change.
And it's the change. And then the wall. It is, in fact, 10,000 kilometers of capital W wall, a defender for every 200 meters, 50,000 defenders on duty at any time, another 50,000 on the other shift, so 100,000 on duty, day in, day out. The only things that can happen are bad things, so you want nothing to happen. So it's like your job is to guard stasis. In order to guard stasis, like the entire youth of the country is standing at the edges. And then the thing they're not doing while they're standing there is also with a capital letter B. They're not breeding. Because basically, not only do you want to keep other people from coming in, but nobody in the country feels like having children anymore either. So
and yet there's a demographic problem.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a demographic problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is,
yeah.
I mean...
Right.
Seems like there could be a solution.
Right. And then the final point being, you know, which goes to this issue of like whether this is a non-racist or a racialized account, which is you're not supposed to let anyone in. But if you do let someone in, each person who comes in, one of the defenders is thrown out.
Right. So it's an explicit.
It's an explicitly zero sum lifeboat. Yeah.
And the other who gets in is themselves not executed or expelled out, but they're given a chip and then made one of the help.
Which is a capital H, sort of
a fluid domestic service class, which you can take on willfully as long as you feed and house them at any given point.
And who are the property of the state.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the race thing is, Elizabeth and I were talking about this before. It really is, I think, the most important, interesting part of the book, the more I think about it. Because I think that the flood refugee parallel is kind of forced. I mean, this is something that people who study this point out, is that this assumed direct relation between climate change and displacement is actually overdrawn, in the sense that there's as much likelihood of people being locked into the place that they're in as there is of them being pushed out of it, because it takes resources to travel. You can't move if you have nothing. It's much more likely that you die in place than you get to where you're going.
So can I say that totally makes sense to me, Quinn? But the way I understood the overlay of those two types of terror, like the climate change threatening our borders and the human capital flood, was more like an account of the cognitive panic that you might undergo as you saw it. I mean, if you just think about, you know, we haven't really touched on this issue of like why it is that people have flocked to far-right ideologies lately, but, you know, there is, there's clearly people find themselves in a kind of cognitive duress where they start believing irrational things. And I think things that in retrospect, they will understand to have been irrational, but nonetheless, it can take hold.
Right. So that's where the generational story is interesting in The Wall too. Is sort of because it seems like the main characters that we have who have grown up after the change.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think that's almost definitely borrowed directly from the East Germany, West Germany case, because when the wall fell, it was still referred to as Die Wende, the change.
Huh.
So in this case, the change leads to the erection of a wall.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to have any of the argument there about why they should be so afraid of the others, except just that they are.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like you're saying, that's just like a reflexive thing.
Yeah.
But it makes you wonder, I mean, is the generation before supposed to have been persuaded by some kind of welfare state, overburdening type explanation?
Right.
If so, you don't really see much of a trace of it, right? It's all just naturalized.
And it's really interactional, right? You're afraid of the others because you know the others will immediately kill you because they will have to.
Right. And if you let them in, then you will be
expelled.
So no, the thing I thought was going to come into the novel more, but it certainly exists in a parallel to the Camp of the Saints, is that question of the traitors in our midst, like the sympathizers, the people who are willing to, you know, let the others in. Do you guys have a thought about that? I mean, it's the kind of presence, non-presence of that as a plot device.
Well, that was actually the sentence that I pulled out from the Camp of the Saints to share, was this very colonel, this proud last Western man, says at some point, in war, the real enemy is always behind the lines. Because it does seem to unite all three of these, that in the end it's a question of betrayal from within and the threat of like the fifth column, right, or the kind of insidiousness of an idea among your own rather than the embodied threat of people
and
from
maybe
outside.
Even inside yourself, right?
Yeah.
Your own humanitarian impulses
are going need to be
placed.
So this is a great time to pivot to our recallable books. So if you don't believe in your future, at least you can take some solace in the past. We conclude with recommendations basically for further reading on the topic that we have raised today. And as with the books we discussed, there will be links to those on our website, along with other material for folks who want to explore this topic further. So Quinn, as our guest, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Well, this book actually hasn't quite come out yet.
Okay, great.
It'll be out in the next couple
of
months.
So it is from the future.
Yeah. It is from the future. It's the title of the book is Mutant Neoliberalism, and it's an edited volume, edited by William Callison and Zach Manfredi. We published on Fordham University Press, and it gathers some really interesting writing, including Melinda Cooper writing about the anti-austerity of the far right. So this is the difference between the kind of libertarians of the AFD and then the kind of welfare chauvinists of the Front National. Etienne Balibar, who's been an extraordinary writer on the idea of Europe for many years. Mm. Wendy Brown has a chapter in there. A couple of other people do. And I think it's the best, it will be the best collection so far to kind of account for 2016 as something other than just the jungle growing back as kind of the beltway punditocracy would like us to understand it.
That sounds great. Mm. Elizabeth?
Yeah, so mine actually picks up on the last bit of our discussion. And it's by Douglas Holmes. It's an ethnography of central bankers and monetarism and central bankers. It's called Economy of Words. That's sort of about how, really about the move, a particular kind of move away from gold, and the central bank's kind of, you know, the thing that was thought to be the main job of central banks, which was to take care of gold. As a kind of safeguard of the nation, among other kinds of things that you described so well, in favor of a kind of sort of performative economics-based semiotic function of controlling the money supply through things like quantitative easing and other kinds of techniques, and how that the book is about. Is centrally focused on that, but I think that tension between the sort of economy of words and the economy of something that supposedly comes from outside of the world of words is really central to what we've been talking about.
It's what Paul Volcker called the mystique of central banking. You needed to speak in such a way that it was gnomic enough that people could read other things in than what you intended.
And I'm doing a project on gold, and I had interlocutors say, you know, we've moved from a gold standard to a PhD standard, and who's to say which one is better?
So I picked up a sort of a different strand of our discussion. So I went back to, I was just sort of brooding on 73 and 74 and the question of governmentality back then. And so I went the other direction towards science fiction, as I often do. And I picked up Ursula Le Guin's 1974 book, The Dispossessed, An Ambiguous Utopia. And actually, it connects in many ways to what we're talking about today, especially in that question of like how you constitute governmentality while still distrusting the state, because it's sort of a, you know, open secret that Le Guin is, among other things, trying to work out some kind of anarchist politics. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think of what she does as a sort of solitary solidarity. Like, so she wants people to be on their own and yet nonetheless want to live and coexist with one another. Mm-hmm. And so she takes the tradition of sort of utopian democratic socialism, which just asserts people will just love one another, and it's kind of a dark, grave version of that, because she thinks you can live in a world of privation and limited resources where you're going to have to struggle with one another, but she thinks that there are mechanisms for getting there that are not nation or state bound mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting novel. It's like Camp of the Saints, it's kind of strange as a novel, but I think it's just a thoughtful exploration of what it would mean to want out of liberalism and not be sure, you know, how you get connective tissue without it. So all right. Well, Quinn, thank you so much. And yeah. I will just say that Recall This Book is hosted by John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. Sound editing is by Claire Ogden. Website design and social media by Matthew Schratz. And if you like this episode, you might want to check out our discussion of women and politics with Manduhai Buyendelgeher, and the one about addiction and habits and dependency with Gina Torrigiano. Not because I'm saying right-wing politics is addiction. just interesting connection. Further episodes coming up include a conversation with the Chinese science fiction writer Shishen Liu, another one with Zadie Smith. I want to say future Nobel laureate Zadie Smith. And also with the poet David Ferry and biologist E.O. Wilson. Finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to tweet about us, mention the show on Facebook, or write a review and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. So thank you very much for listening.